Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. A recurring theme on this podcast is how much of our food system is invisible to most of us, including those of us who actively pay attention. That's why today's conversation is a perfect example. RJ Taylor is a second-generation fish farmer and a passionate voice for aquaculture in Ontario and across the country. His family's operation spans hatcheries, net pens, processing, home delivery, and a deeply rooted partnership with First Nations on Manitoulin Island. And one of the questions that I couldn't stop thinking about as we had our conversation was how so much of the future of feeding the world is happening underwater. Not so much out of sight, but certainly out of mind. And there are multiple layers of nuance, of technology, of regulation that shape how this food is produced. And so I think this episode not only highlights the ample opportunities for us to learn, but also some of the difficulties, some of the challenges, the flexibility and innovation required by a lot of the entrepreneurs that we call farmers. And in this case, I think RJ really exemplifies that kind of resilience, that kind of flexibility, really the kind of drive that is required to be a leader, to find success in the agriculture, agri-food, in this case, aquaculture sector. So let's tune in and learn. RJ, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I've got a bit of a tradition where the first question is really meant as an intuitive, kind of straight from the gut. What does the future mean to you?
In general? Wow, what a broad question. I think the future is optimism. I have full faith that we're going to have 6 million more problems to solve, but we're going to find 7 million different solutions for them.
Right on. Very succinct. Now, I've been really looking forward to chatting with you ever since Jen made the connection and introduced us, because I have to acknowledge I know absolutely nothing about aquaculture. And my kind of understanding of where our food comes from, for pure geographic bias, has always been a little landlocked. And yet, you're not that far from where I've spent most of my life. So I kind of feel that you're fleshing out a part of Ontario's food system that I have been tragically ignorant of. But before we go there, I love starting with the kind of origin question or the lore question. And in your case, you kind of came into this through family. So I'd love to hear both a two-parter. You know, where did you get your passion from? Because you clearly have a lot. And why did you stay? And I say this because you share in common a lot of the guests in that your talent is so overwhelming that I suspect you could have made a lot of choices in terms of career paths. So how did you end up where you are, which seems to be kind of where you started?
That's a really good question. And, you know, so I'm second generation now. My parents started our business, but my dad's love for fish farming started like almost 60 years ago. He started as a fish feed sales rep in Elmira, Ontario, and it was a feed company that saw this promise for aquaculture and what it could bring, but there were no fish farms. So it actually would help finance fish farms. It was Martin Mills, and then sell them feed. And so that was when my dad sort of took this bridge from being a feed rep into aquaculture, got involved in all sorts of different partnerships, but always had his eye on his own farm. So my parents bought an old fly fishing club in the mid 80s. And my dad, the patient man, spent 9 years fighting with different levels and agencies of government to actually get all the permits to build the farm. And then that was where my sister and I grew up. So I tell a story where, you know, my sister and I, although we're 2 years apart, her name is Arlen. By the time we were sort of both in that sort of 16 to 18 years old mark, we kind of looked at each other, and we spent many mornings loading fish trucks before school, many weekends picking fish eggs out of the troughs, very, very manual activities on the farm. And we looked at each other and we said, we're both not going to be fish farmers, right? Oh yeah, we're not going to be fish farmers. And she took off for sub-Saharan Africa, in international development, places like Mozambique, South Africa, Angola, for almost 10 years. And then I left home. I left the small town at 17, went off, did it, got a sociology and business degree. And then I sort of found my way into a science and research innovation communication career for most of my 20s. But there came a time, and it was sort of synonymous for both of us, where we really realized that that aquaculture and just agriculture writ large is something special. And also my parents were getting older. And there was just a space for us at the farm, but also we had a very big idea of what we wanted it to become. And so she jumped back in about 12 years ago, and then I jumped back in about 10 years ago. So.
Right on. And I'd love, there was a lot there I want to unpack as we
yes,
speak.
Yes, sorry.
No, don't apologize, please. This is me getting excited as a learner. But I kind of want to ask you another foundational question, which, as you were describing it, you know, you mentioned some of the regulatory hurdles your dad had to go through and some of the licensing mm-hmm. hurdles. It kind of begs the question, like, what is the culture of aquaculture? And I say this because the culture of agriculture is something I think that people take for granted, that is easy to see when you drive on rural roads. But fish farms are not necessarily things you're going to see when you drive on the road, unless you have a boat and you are able to spend time kind of out and about. But I'm curious, you mentioned a little bit about his passionate ideas, but what's the larger, and I say this because I know you're active in the broader association, what is the culture of aquaculture in Ontario, and how has it advanced or even accelerated over the last few decades?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. So I think that the passion, the culture inside the industry is filled with passion, you know? And I think every fish farmer, be it, you know, their first year on the job or been doing it for 50 years, kind of takes on a certain responsibility to educate their friends, anybody that asks, the person on the train or the plane next to them. And I think there's always this extreme passion about the sector. And I really took that for granted and didn't realize it was there until I wound my own path in all sorts of different places. You know, and a great story for that is one of my good friends that lives probably not too far from you, Jesse. She told me a couple years ago, she's like, people ask me about my job and, you know, I just have this corporate office job and it's good. But people ask you about your job and you tell them like they're supposed to be excited about your job and what you're doing in fish farming, because it's something to get excited about. She's just like, I can't imagine talking to people about my job and feeling that way. And so I think that's the culture within our sector. But I think in Ontario and Canada, it's largely like sort of an if you know, you know. Like if you take the even 5 minutes to do some sort of critical research, or you have some sort of impact with a fish farm or a good news story or something, you sort of see the bright future that is fish farming. But there's also sort of a dark side to that coin, which is like the social media generation where, you know, a 30-second TikTok video about one bad farm sort of paints a picture that maybe all the farms are bad. So our responsibility, and something that a lot of us fish farmers talk about, is encouraging this culture of just like ask a few critical questions about the amazingness that is fish farming, and you're going to find some really cool information. And, you know, I think it was around 2020 is when globally we tipped the scales where over half of the fish and seafood consumed was from aquaculture. And I think now we're somewhere around the 60-65% mark. And by the end of this decade, it's going to be like at least three quarters where it really is the future of feeding the world. And definitely here in Ontario, lots of fish farms here people don't know about, and across Canada.
Right on. And you're certainly connecting a through line I've seen in a number of our episodes with our guests, that communications is so central to our practices today, particularly because, to your point, of the need to share the passion, enthusiasm, and knowledge around these practices. I do want to unpack that, but I'm still at the novice level of my understanding here.
Okay.
Help me wrap my head around geography. Because, again, with agriculture, okay, the geography is pretty straightforward. There's land. There's thoughts about the quality of the soil of the land or the access to transportation infrastructure, you know, various elements around ownership of the land. How does that work with farm fishing in terms of, you know, where yeah. in the water, the conditions that allow that area in the water to lend itself towards successful fish farming? And then not just in Ontario, if you might kind of help me imagine this across Canada, where are the active centers of fish farming in which this kind of activity and innovation is happening?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the interesting thing about fish farming is that it really is nothing like, say, chicken farming, where sort of every chicken barn you see that's built in the last decade kind of looks the same. It's a very sort of formulaic approach. You kind of know what you put in and what you're going to get out. But for fish farming, it's very different because you're often working with a unique geography, a unique water source, and trying to create the right conditions for growing fish. So the Canada-wide context is that the aquaculture sector is definitely dominated by Atlantic salmon farms along the coasts, so the east and the west coasts. So those fish are often, they spend, you know, their first year or year and a half on a land-based hatchery of sorts. And then they're sort of what we call a hatchery. And then they move out to like an ocean-based net pen system, which gives them a lot more water, a lot more space, and then they grow them to market size there in an incredibly low energy consumption, low carbon way. So that's definitely the biggest players in the sector. But what I love to celebrate is that there's actually all sorts of different kinds of fish farming happening, like in every single province, and even up in the Yukon. And then here in Ontario is a great example. So we have several smaller land-based farms. So they're using like a spring or a well or a river, and they're borrowing that water for a little bit, using it, settling it out, and then sending it on its way. There are some sort of what we call recirculating systems, which is a more sort of space age, like it's kind of half farm, half water treatment to reuse the water. Still experimental from an economic point of view. There are some successes, but there's way more failures. And then we also have like a company that's rehabilitating old aggregate or gravel quarries and introducing fish farms to like repopulate and rehabilitate that. But here in Ontario, the most common way is that a fish sort of spends its time on a land-based hatchery that first sort of year and a half. And then there's about a dozen or so net pen sites in Georgian Bay, Parry Sound, all around Manitoulin Island, that they're growing up to market size there. Something very different about fish compared to other livestock is just the sheer time it takes to get them to market. So we're trying to grow a 3-pound rainbow trout or steelhead here in Ontario. That takes 2.5 to 3 years. And some of those big Atlantic salmon fillets you see can sometimes take up to 4 years to get to market. So,
well, and thank you. That's been a really good, for me, kind of framework to understand how aquaculture, how farm fishing, fish farms fits within the larger industry. How does your operation, how does your family's operation, how has it evolved? And I say that partly because, to your earlier point of, there was a point where you and your sister were like, no way, we're not sticking around, to the point now that you clearly are really excited about this stuff. And, you know, yeah. you're dealing with something that not only takes a few years in terms of being able to get to market, but I'm assuming the knowledge and the infrastructure behind that is even greater long term. So how are you thinking about all this? How are you approaching it, given your passion and your excitement? Where do you see the future of this particular part of the industry?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And I can give a bit of context for where we are now, and then sort of where we came from. So the single farm that Arlen and I grew up on, you know, I talk about it as being very ma and pa like. It was at a time where there was a lot of little land-based farms, fish farms in Ontario. I think there was close to 200 of them. And everyone was doing something a little bit different and trying to do it all. So different species of fish, trying to grow some for restocking, like rehabilitating wild populations, recreational fishing, but then also growing some for like human consumption and that side of things. And then growing different life phases. So some might be good for spawning and eggs and the little guys, other ones might be better for growing out. And at that time, because the business was so small, there wasn't the money, let's say, to invest in some of the automated equipment. But when we fast forward 30 years, we get a lot more done because we have a lot more equipment. So we operate 4 land-based hatcheries. We have our own net pen site. It's a joint partnership with Sheshagawanin First Nation up on Manitoulin Island. And then we also operate our own processing plant. But what's funny is the transition of our business went from sort of ma and pa, very almost diversified in a sense. And then in sort of the 2010s, we really started concentrating the business on rainbow trout fingerlings. So juveniles, that's our fun name for little rainbow trout. And that's because they're a high value product, let's say, that we would sell on to the net pen farms in Ontario and Saskatchewan, even into Quebec. Some go to Nova Scotia. We really focused the business on that. And that was part of that like business school learning, right? Focus on your core competencies. But what that did is it actually left us really exposed to some changes in the market, because fish farming is like any other kind of farming. We're seeing a lot of acquisitions and consolidation. And, you know, when our customer list of, you know, 15 different farms, you know, eventually whittles down to one, that leaves us in a pretty precarious position. And so Arlen and I actually took that whole business textbook thing and threw it out the window. And we started diversifying again. So we went from really focused on these rainbow trout breeding program and fingerlings to now we're growing rainbow trout, Arctic char, coho salmon, and lake whitefish. And then we also grow sort of smaller batches of those. We have a big home delivery program in Ontario where we deliver to about 1,500 to 1,700 homes every single month, our own fish, and then we source from others. We do the farmers markets and lots of small retail stores. But then, you know, so we're diversified in that boutique niche space. But then thanks to our partnership up on Manitoulin and being able to grow on such a large scale, especially rainbow trout steelhead up there, we're supplying the big retailers like Loblaws is an excellent partner for us. And we're sort of into that mass market space. So we've found, and we really encourage others too, to like take this diversified approach, because it just leaves you more resilient to these changes we're seeing in the market. And I honestly don't think that any one of our areas that we do could cover it all. It's the fact that we try and do absolutely everything all the time that really helps us through. And I see that in the sector writ large, not necessarily the big salmon companies, but a lot of other farms across the country growing different species.
Right on. And again, the side of this being a great conversation is not only am I learning tons, but I'm overwhelmed with the follow-up questions and I have to choose and prioritize. I do, for example, want to talk to you about the kind of ecosystem of your production, because what you just described there was truly fascinating. But I do have to take a moment to take the digression, and it's not really a digression, around the relationship you have with First Nations and the type of work you're doing there, mm-hmm. partly because that is a recurring thread of this podcast, is, you know, the potential of really further empowering and connecting First Nations communities across the country into the sector. So please lay out kind of the work you're doing and the work you'd like to be doing, you know, in terms of potentially expanding it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I must say, you know, through my work as a sort of a fish farmer front and center and working directly with one community, and then also working sort of to represent our fish farming sector in Ontario that works with a lot of different communities, it's strange sometimes being at the different agriculture tables, because people talk about how we need to include the First Nations in what we're doing and indigenization and all of this, but our sector has had so many First Nations communities like play such a big role in it that like it really is a partly Indigenous sector. And I was just having dinner with an amazing gentleman, Ben Canassaway, who's been operating a farm up at Wickwemekong on Manitoulin for over 30 years. And we were having a chat and trying to figure out, we were looking at the geography of all the farms, and we figure like over 75% of the fish farms in Ontario operate on a First Nations territory and through some sort of a partnership that helps bring that to market. So if I step back for a second, I'll say that in Ontario, there's actually two ways to get an aquaculture license when we see these net pens out in the lake. One of them is through the Ministry of Natural Resources, provincial jurisdiction. But that group has not issued a new aquaculture license for a cage farm, or a net pen farm, in at least like two decades. The second way is through a partnership with a First Nation, and then they enact what they call the Great Aquaculture Law, Gnakchakewin, and then they can issue aquaculture permits through band council resolutions. And I must say that that flexibility has really been probably like the single reason that our sector has flourished and grown so much in Ontario, because provincially, it's been really, really hard to get new licenses, and the regulatory system is cumbersome. There's so many different groups involved that don't talk to each other. And so trying to get new licenses in place is really, really challenging. And then when they try and figure out what the criteria for those are, they're relying on old documents from like the 70s and 80s, or studies from the 90s. Like, it's so out of date for how much the lake has changed. But working with the First Nations, they are able to bring on different consultants, and they have a really great partner in the Wabatec Business Development Corporation. And so the licenses are actually based on excellent science that's really showing if the farms are having an impact or not. And it's also able to change and be negotiated as environment changes and as climate change brings in new things. And then I will say too that the idea that a First Nations farm is, you know, the illegal farm because it doesn't have a government license, I really challenge that perspective, because all of the First Nations licensed farms in Ontario actually have this third-party eco-certification called Best Aquaculture Practices. Very, very tough to get audited on every year, requires immense environmental monitoring well beyond what the province expects. And I think all of them have been licensed for at least 5 years, including ours. And so it really like shows that the bar for what these sites are is so high. And then it has this whole aspect too, where these, you know, in our case, Sheshagwaning First Nation on Manitoulin, that chief and council really motivated about growing food, really motivated about the youth and the next generation. And so they're not just looking for, you know, license fees out of this. They're looking for like a food partner and a harvest share and like high school co-op opportunities and like youth enrichment activities. And so there's the much more colorful relationship around these fish farms than, you know, what would happen with a provincial license. So
yeah, I don't know if this is the right time to interject the question, but it seems to me, RJ, when you're talking about aquaculture and feeding people, we tend to look at it through an agricultural lens, but I'm not sure how well aquaculture fits into traditional agriculture. And I'm wondering if you could talk to that a little bit. I know you sit on a lot of agricultural roundtables and boards, but it doesn't feel like aquaculture really fits neatly into Ontario agriculture landscape. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, no. So I must say that growing up on a fish farm and being in a fish farming family, I grew up with this idea that fish farms were somehow special and unique, and there isn't a box to check. But that perspective has really been changed for me in the last sort of five or so years, as I've gotten more involved in the agriculture sector and organizations like Livestock Research Innovation Corporation, or recently the Crown Agency, Agricultural Research and Innovation Ontario. I've had that really challenged, because actually when I sit around the table with other farmers, specifically livestock producers, I find that we're thinking about and worried about all of the same things. So we all have very high capital businesses with low margins, high risk. You know, there are business risk management programs, but we're still sort of largely self-insured. And then also we're in a government ecosystem that can't change and adapt quick enough for the types of changes we're seeing with climate change. So I've really found a place for us in the agricultural community. And I think Ontario seems to have really embraced that, which is nice. But I think that there's definitely further to go for some of that recognition. Like, we're not involved. We can file as a farm through CRA, but we're not eligible for the Canadian Agricultural Partnerships Program. There's all sorts of motley crew coverage for us. What I will say is that we're often managed from a government lens through a natural resource lens. And what that means is, like, we're viewed as like commercial fishing or, you know, industries like forestry that are largely short-term, extractive, and sort of managed by the government, not us. And I've never really found a home for us in those spaces. Even federally, putting us in Fisheries and Oceans Canada, like, they manage commercial fishing. It's just, when I'm with commercial fisher folk, I just don't have the same sort of idea about what we're doing and the generational aspect to it and the caring for the animals for so long and some of the pressures that are coming with things like climate change. I find a home with other farmers in a way that I don't with natural resource sectors. But
now, be careful. The more you make that argument, the more you justify why you should be in the same bucket as commercial fishing operations, because they should be learning from you. They perhaps should be, you know, setting their values and perspectives from where you're coming from. But I want to circle back to something you said earlier, and I think it ties into what we're describing here quite nicely, although, if anything, it complicates what we're describing. You know, you mentioned that you're now engaging with grocery, that you're sort of directly interfacing with the kind of mass market, and you are a communications person who clearly, not just as a communicator, but as a listener, as someone who pays attention to society and public perception, how is that working out? What are some of the challenges? What are some of your aspirations? And I say this to try to connect, you know, the work being done with First Nations, the work being done in terms of generating food, the, you know, then translating that into market choices, because we are kind of dependent upon the customer saying, oh, I'd like to have trout tonight, or, oh, I'd like to have fish tonight. How do you see that happening? Again, this is me as a novice really trying to wrap my head around this. But what are the challenges you face? What are the aspirations you have around communicating not just the value proposition of what you do, but the end product so that people buy it, need it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I recently I've been exploring the concept of offshoring our environmental impact, and I find the fish and the seafood industry is really, really bad for this in a couple ways. The first one is mislabeling in fish and seafood is, like, I think it's probably, aside from like shredded cheese, I think it's the most mislabeled product when it comes to the ingredients. I think a study by Oceana Canada a couple years ago, and they repeat this every few years, took like hundreds of samples from five different Canadian cities, and they found that over 40% of the fish was mislabeled by species. And that's not even mislabeled by species. Like, when we factor in the eco certifications that we all support and invest so heavily in to show the public that we're being, you know, top tier sustainable, or when we think of country of origin, like, those are two other areas that are also, I know firsthand, are very, very mislabeled. So I think that the recent push in Canada, and I was just reading about it in the paper this morning, about when you put from Canada on a label, what exactly does that mean? Because there is a lot of this sort of maple washing happening. And so a good example of that was right, like, about a year ago, we saw a bunch of trout coming in from Colombia. They were selling it into the States, but with all the tariffs and stuff, they needed to dump it real quick into somewhere. And so they dumped it into Canada. And so we just saw all this Colombian rainbow trout pop up in the market out of nowhere. And because it came in a box and then got put in a piece of styrofoam in a grocery store in Canada, it said product of Colombia and Canada, you know? And so I think that the recent consumer shift towards like really pushing for what is Canadian, what is on the label and is it accurate is helping. But I think back to your sort of your bigger, more aspirational point, I think that just trying to focus on communicating the power of an eco certification is really an area that I focus on quite heavily. Because through all of our social media interactions and customer interactions, I get a lot of that age-old question of like, farmed or wild? And for me, like, I just don't, when people ask me that question, I like to ask them in return, like, when you say that, are you worried about the environment or your health? Like, what, where does that come from? Because if those are the two things you're worried about, like, it being wild or farmed is not the question to ask, because there's lots of poorly managed wild fish out there, polluted waters, human slavery. I mean, you can go on Netflix and watch documentaries about that. But there are lots of well-managed fish stocks out there, like Pickerel and Lake Erie has a Marine Stewardship Council label. And it's the same with fish farms. Like, there's the odd bad farm out there. They tend to get most of the media attention, but there's lots of really good farms out there. So I really try and push the eco certifications. And I must say that I see a lot of the retailers sort of getting on board with that. And we have found a really excellent partner in Loblaws and all their banner stores that have really worked quite closely with us to communicate our message, make sure that we have a packaging where we can share the story on it, because we see more purchases if we can put this Sheshagawanin Odawa Island Farms or the Spring Hills logo on it. So,
and you know, I'd love to have you unpack.
I digress. Please keep the questions coming. I'll talk. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, you're again appropriately connecting a whole bunch of things here that are, you know, both helping my understanding, but helping focus some of the future questions. And your point about having an effective partner does make me kind of want to imagine who are the other partners. And I'll get to that in a moment. I will, as an aside, both for some of the people I know listening and for yourself, a fascinating digression is wilderness as a social construct and the role that the politics of wilderness has played, especially given that North America has been cultivated for thousands of years. I digress. What are the other kind of partners that you could imagine having that really help achieve the kind of vision that I'm hearing you describe? One is obviously grocery. But one of the interesting recurring threads we've had here on the podcast is the role of culture in having people decide what they eat. You're a communications person. How do you think about that? I kind of alluded to this earlier, and I'd love to kind of, you know, bring it to the forefront of our conversation. I do think that the issues around fish have impacted, and I'm being vague there, have impacted people's food choices. You've been talking about countering that. How do you do it at a cultural level? How do you literally get people eating more Ontario fish?
Yeah. I do strongly believe there's a role for government in here. I find that, unfortunately, because of salmon farming in BC, not to debate the science or not, but like culturally speaking, they definitely have been losing the battle in BC when it comes to those fish farms. And I think that it's left such a, whenever I talk to folks in government, they say, oh, what a political hot potato, and they step away from it. And I find that lack of government support kind of allows the sector to run stagnant. You know, even across Canada, I think we've been producing the same amount of farmed fish for almost 20 years. And that's sort of Canada-wide, even though here in Ontario, we've been growing substantially, but it's obviously not the same across the country. But I think that the politicians I often find are very hesitant to talk about aquaculture because it is contentious and they like to stay away from contentious things. And I think that that can create a little bit of a buzzkill for investors, for even consumers, for different environmental groups, for teachers who want to talk about different farming types in school and things like that. But I want to maintain my optimism because I do I do see a lot of different groups very interested in telling the positive story of fish. And I often find it's in that sort of farming niche that we benefit from that, you know, working with organizations in Ontario like Eggscape that create resources for teachers to sort of share some of this. But I also think that, you know, on our social media, we get a lot of questions, really sometimes out from left field or bring people quoting articles. Like, I have to say that prior to us launching this home delivery vehicle and having a bit of a brand, Spring Hills Online, that people could engage with, the only way our sector really talked to the public was through our industry association. And I remember we would talk and we would put out social media posts and do press advisories, and like nobody cared, because nobody really wants to hear from some nameless industry association. But I was the guy behind those messages. And then as soon as I had my own farm with my own sort of enough of a presence online to, you know, allow some momentum to grow, people were all over it. I'd be sharing the exact same things and they'd be so excited to be engaging with a farm on these issues and be able to ask questions. And I think that we just need more of that. Like, I would love other producers to be doing that. I would love other companies and other individual farmers. It's a time investment for sure, but really it's not. And anytime somebody messages us online, the first question I always answer it with, or if my sister's on there or somebody else at the farm answers, is like, thank you for asking this question. The world would be a better place if everyone asked these questions about their food. And then we answer the question, because I truly do believe that just having a little bit of curiosity, like the tiniest little bit, just like cracks the door open for so much understanding, not just about fish farming, but farming and food.
Can I do a follow-up question on that? I believe we need to hear from our farmers far more than we need to hear from our industry organizations. That's a bit of a hot take. And I'm wondering, how do you encourage farmers to step outside of their comfort zone so that they are willing to put themselves out there and to tell their stories and to educate people about where their food is coming from?
I think that I'm sorry for anyone who's asked a question from us online that might be listening to this, but we have a giant Google Doc of answers to all the most common questions, because trying to answer each question uniquely can be a bit of a challenge when there's a lot of it. And so there's a little bit of copy and paste. But I think that, like, I think maybe the role of like an industry association or something is to maybe give a little bit of those talking points to like start weaving the tapestry of the answers that they could give, because I know just getting hit by all sorts of questions out of the blue can be a little bit overwhelming. And I also think that as soon as you tie some of those interactions to sales, so if you have like farmers markets or a farm store, or you do self-guided farm tours or things like that, it gives you the excitement to answer these questions, because it's kind of tied to sales. It's not just so, you know, up in the air, oh, I'm doing a good thing, education. But, you know, I think I would encourage those farmers that interact with the public in person to be investing that time online, and the motivation for that can often kind of come from sales. So,
well, and it kind of,
that'd be my short answer, my less than hot take.
It kind of, you know, enables or creates opportunity for another question that is a recurring thread here on the podcast, which is, you know, regulatory confusion or regulatory hurdles aside, how accessible is the sector currently? Like, if someone was really excited by listening to you talk and then went further to learn more about what you're doing, it was like, wow, this is the industry, this is the sector I want to be in. How accessible is it now? Again, regulatory morass aside, and what could make it even more accessible? And I say this in the sense that, you know, you could have gone elsewhere. You did for a certain point, and you came back. Do you think more people need to be attracted to the sector? And regardless, how accessible is it?
Yeah. Well, I think if you are a standalone person and you decide that your first interaction to start a new farm is government, you will be sadly disappointed. There are some excellent champions in the provincial government if you somehow find their contact details and that will help you along. But I think that the best thing to do is to engage with, just ask the questions of other farmers. And I think because we have a little bit more of a presence online and we're in the Google search words, we get a lot of folks very interested. I had this woman call me from Ottawa. She's like, I live in social housing, but I see a spot in my basement I can put a fish tank in. How do I put some fish in and grow them? You know? And I think that if you're engaging with that, we have a great conference every year with a really good community. And a lot of our farms are not, like, it's not a secretive sector. If you ask to go visit a farm, you're all, and whoever it is, they'll almost always say yes, because people are really excited to talk in, about what they're doing and share their the things that they've learned. So I think that if it is accessible, if you kind of come at it through the right pathway, and that sort of talking to other farmers, that'll probably direct to our association. But sometimes with government, there isn't really like a one window approach. There's a lot of different ministries and it can be pretty overwhelming, that I think we could use some improvement on.
I mean, I'm kind of leapfrogging what tends to be one of the later questions, but I'll use it now only because it's a natural follow-up. You know, imagine that I've taken over the Prime Minister's office, and consequently my friends have taken over the Ontario Provincial office. And we're like, RJ, all right, we're in a position to really rearrange the regulatory environment to help the industry. What are the policies? What are the frameworks that from your perspective are a no-brainer and that we should be seriously considering?
I think the federal and provincial governments have done an excellent job at working with the Wabatec Business Development Corporation to get new aquaculture projects on different Indigenous reserves, different First Nations communities. Last I talked to them, they had over three dozen different projects of different sizes. Some really large scale, like a recirculating farm for Lake Whitefish. Others are just like a small hatchery for walleye for restocking and things like that. So I think that enabling that is a really positive step. But I think that, you know, we've had some challenges here in Ontario because we want to farm Lake Whitefish. Lake Whitefish populations are at sort of an all-time low in the wild. It's very hard. Even the researchers that we've had working around the farms, taking samples, are having it really difficult to find Lake Whitefish. But still, the government is hesitant about allowing us to farm this species because it might have some impact on the wild populations if a fish escapes or something like that, which is very rare, by the way. But yet the populations are at an all-time low in the wild. And so there's that lack of like helping, there's this sort of lack of supporting the sector to work in the larger fish ecosystem. But I think that a really good way to look at it is if we look at a country like Norway, like aquaculture is huge there. And if you go out on the streets of Oslo or those places and you ask, you know, the millennial, the Gen Zs, where's the future of Norway? They're going to say, when oil's done, aquaculture is what's going to be our future. You know, like, we've made lots of money off oil, but the next generation is going to be aquaculture because it's such an embraced industry there. And Norway has a third of the viable aquaculture area that a place like Canada has. You know, we have about 75,000 square kilometers in this country from the Great Lakes to the coasts that we could be using to farm fish. And that's three times what Norway has. But yet we produce less than 10% of what Norway does. You know, Norway's like 1.6 million metric tons and we produce like 120,000 or something. And I think that there just has never really been like a promotional countrywide like drive to really push this sector. It's really been specific companies, specific champions trying to like get their businesses going, sort of against what the sort of the government has. But if I were the prime minister, I would take the entire aquaculture mandate out of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and I would move it over to Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. Instead of this piecemeal, is it a natural resource? Is it farming? Let's just recognize it as farming, because I think that farming writ general has a better economic development mandate and a way of working with the land and water to produce food instead of like viewing them as separate, which I'd also love to get into, this idea of nature as an attraction instead of all around us that we are using to produce food. I love your wilderness reference there. So yeah, that's the first thing I would do.
Although again, I think you're selling yourself short. If anything, you know, negotiating tactics mean always demand or ask for greater than what you expect to receive. So demand the Ministry of Aquaculture. Don't be a stepchild.
Yes. Yeah. There we go. Aquaculture. Let's do it.
There was a question I wanted to ask earlier that you kind of evoked again. So this is, you know, more of a sweep up. And while RJ is answering this question, Jen, why don't you think if there's any closing questions you have, because we are starting to run out of time. You've used the word ecosystem a few times, and I love the word ecosystem, partly because I'm a systems thinker. And there's two sides to this question, and you could connect them and treat them as the same question, or you can treat them as distinct questions. That's up to you. But on the one hand, it's okay. Clear that your industry relies upon researchers, relies upon research, relies upon scientists. Where are they coming from? What are the institutions? What are, you know, the infrastructure of that brain trust that enables the growth of the industry? And then on the flip side, for yourself and your operations, how are you experiencing your own ecosystem? Like, my hypothesis here is I have to imagine the water that you end up as a consequence of some of the fish farming could be very fertile, very valuable to growers who these days are paying an arm and a leg for fertilizer. So give me a sense of the larger ecosystem around both just your operations, but also around the sector that will allow it to thrive and grow in the way that you wish it to.
Yeah. Well, I must say, a huge shout out to the University of Guelph. There's actually a pretty significant amount of researchers at all levels that support our sector. We have an amazing Ontario Aquaculture Research Center here in Ontario, which coincidentally used to be my father's farm with several partners until he sold it to ARIO and the university in the 80s. But I will say that the idea that a net pen farm out in the lake is a bad thing is, I think, some sort of misconception imported from other places in the world. You know, if you get on YouTube and look up, you can, I'm sure, find some scary farms. But here in Ontario, the Fisheries and Oceans Canada partnered with a bunch of different folks in different universities to do this huge 20-year study in the Experimental Lakes area, where they introduced a small net pen fish farm that was way oversized for the lake, just to measure the impacts of this farm. And within 5 years of them operating it, the wild lake trout populations doubled. They were spawning years earlier. And the only real sort of negative environmental interaction was a slight reduction in white suckers, because the lake trout love eating them. And then Professor Neil Rooney from the environmental sciences side of the University of Guelph has actually taken that sort of out of the laboratory situation of the experimental lakes. And he's been studying around the net pens that are in Georgian Bay. And he's found the same sort of benefit that really supports the hypothesis that where you have a fish farm, the nutrients there are actually kickstarting local food webs that have been devastated by the zebra and quagga mussels just filtering out all of the nutrients in the water. So when you put a fish farm, you're like helping that area regenerate, and you have more wild fish because of it. And we were just having a chief and council meeting at Sheshagawanning a few weeks ago, and they were telling us that, you know, they haven't seen, you know, rock bass in the bay, or lake whitefish or Chinook salmon in decades. And then all of a sudden, we have this farm operating there for 5 years, and they're seeing all these fish in the bay again. And it's not just because they're eating the stray fish feed. It's actually because the whole ecosystem around the pens is, there's more fish, there's more diversity of fish. So I must say that before I came back to fish farming, you know, I was mainly working in science communication a little bit. There's a little bit of PR in that space. And I found, like, I loved sharing these amazing, positive science stories. And there was just such pickup for them. You know, if you could talk about electric car battery advancements, people love stuff like that. And when you're talking about ways that we're, you know, locking carbon in the soil, people get excited about this. So when I came to fish farming and I heard about these amazing ecology benefit, this regenerative nature of these fish farms, and I would try and share those with different journalists or what have you. And I think nobody really wanted to tell that story because, you know, if we have an escape of 8,000 fish from a fish farm, it's like national news. If anything happens in the BC salmon sector about fish farming, nobody talks about it. Everybody talks about it. But when it comes to telling these really positive stories, I'm just so grateful even that you are having me on, Jesse, to tell this story, because almost nobody really wants to know these stories, which is really, really challenging. So from an ecosystem point of view, I've sort of been learning that the science continues to evolve, that we need to continue telling the stories in addition to the science, because I think that stories and science need to be shared together for both of them to really land. And that's really sort of the bigger picture. At our individual farm, sort of the ecosystem approach, I think that, you know, every fish farmer has to work with unique conditions for their farm. And so we're all just very like entrepreneurial and pioneering. And so any fish farm you go, people love to show you this contraption they built. And so much of what we do doesn't come out of a box or from a supplier like ready built. So there's a lot of different adjustments. And so there is just a natural research and development mindset in fish farmers. And I see that in our business. You know, sometimes I think, you know, we spend half our time growing fish and the other half like building stuff and fixing stuff and making stuff better. And that is like a huge part of, I think, why so many of us also love our jobs. So.
Right on. Jen, did you want to jump in before we start to wind up?
No, you know, I was going to ask RJ, what's the one thing you wish people knew about fish farming? And I think you already answered that. And what has always struck me working with you for a number of years now is just how passionate you are about the industry and how uneducated I was about it until I really started listening to you and working with you. So I just want to thank you for being on the podcast because I think it was awesome.
Thanks, Jen.
Well, and, you know, I think this is both, I think best way to frame this is a backhanded compliment, that on the one hand, this has been, I think, incredibly educational, but on the other hand, that kind of speaks to the challenge that you face, that in dealing with Jen and I, two people who are avid learners of all things food, and we are still getting up to speed. It does suggest that there is quite a bit of popular education that the industry faces, but that in and of itself affirms and recognizes your leadership and the work that you're doing because you are at those front lines. Is there anything that we haven't touched upon today, whether in terms of the aquaculture industry or just in terms of your take on food and where our food comes from, that you want to get into before we start to conclude?
No, I think one thing I have noticed, so as I sort of alluded to, fish farmers are just, we sort of take on this totem, this baton of education in what we're doing. But I will say that this, we're used to what we combat, who we call the antis. And I think that my last decade that I've been in the wider agriculture sector, I'm noticing more antis in that space than I've ever seen before. And it's hard because we see places like BC that didn't, in my opinion, didn't necessarily get out and communicate and educate fast early enough and fast enough and get good enough at the storytelling side of things compared to some of the environmental groups out there. You know, I see some of the ways that that could have been done better. But yet in the wider agriculture sector, you know, I see the same sort of things happening and a sort of like almost ignorance to those messages instead of just taking them straight on. And I will say that, you know, what's happened in the aquaculture sector, at the start, we were so nice about the environmental groups in BC. We were trying to be really nice or we'd ignore them. But now that it's had such dire consequences, you know, Trudeau essentially trying to buy electoral seats on the island by banning fish farming, zero science behind it back then. It's the response now is so loud and like all up in your face if people are trying to say negative things. And it is actually yielding better results, I think, in terms of changing minds and just helping people doubt. So I think in the agriculture sector, the larger food system, we've had such amazing opportunities with COVID and with this sort of the last year of the elbows up, like people asking these questions and really trying to get good answers. But I still think that we need to be like addressing those anti-voices in a way that is trying to help move the needle in like another louder and prouder way. Cause I think if we continue to try and dance around it nicely and hope that, you know, the plant-based movement or, you know, the anti-livestock movement or what have you, like just goes away. It's not going to go away. And we saw that with fish. And I would love to be sharing that message for the wider food sector to continue that education piece. So,
what? But
I will also say, Jesse, I've followed your work and heard your voice for years and years, and it is such an honor to be talking with you because I am fanboying a bit today. You jumped into it. I didn't get a chance to tell you that.
Although, be careful. You're at the end of the conversation, and you don't want to discredit yourself by saying nice things about me. That instantly causes your judgment into question. Jen, you're trying to jump in here.
I just have one more thing to ask, RJ. If people want to learn more about aquaculture or about your farm and the products that you have for sale, where can they find you?
Oh, Spring Hills Fish, at Spring Hills Fish, Instagram, Facebook, or springhillsfish.ca. So.
And now our last question, which is a shout out, and this is like the first question, really meant to be a gut response, a kind of intuitive answer. But who are the people you look up to? Who are the people that you kind of admire? This is, again, the pay it forward part of the segment. You know, whether within the sector or just in the world at large, who you think the rest of us should be paying attention to.
I was hoping you'd talk a little bit longer so I had some time to think that one through, you know? So, no, I must say that I've really found a lot of excitement in some of the recent messaging from Arlene Dickinson about the food system. Every time I read a post about from her on LinkedIn, you know, it just looks like she pulled out her phone and just wrote her thoughts down in a raw way. It really, really hits home for me. You know, she talks a lot about the investment community's lack of interest in investing in agriculture because the margins aren't there. You know, and I think it just seems to shine a spotlight on why we seem as a country to be lagging behind on the productivity in this sector and on just the growth in this sector. So that's really what's been getting me excited recently.
Right on. Well, thank you, RJ. This has been a fantastic crash course in aquaculture, but not an end. I think, if anything, you have primed our appetites to learn more about this particular thriving, growing part of our larger food system. And I suspect we will have you back to extend the conversation. And if anything, help translate a lot of the insights and innovation that you've experienced throughout the larger agri-food system. So thank you very much.
That would be my trout-all honor, Jesse.
That's a wrap on this conversation with RJ Taylor. And I wonder, does that's a wrap come from the fish industry that you've wrapped up the fish to take home? Probably not, but you never know. Whether it's loading fish trucks before school to building something that feeds thousands of households across the province and beyond, RJ's story is a reminder that the most meaningful work often starts close to home, even when you spend years running from it. And that idea he kept coming back to, that diversification, resilience, and genuine partnership are what carry a business through, that certainly holds true well beyond fish farming. And while it resonates, I think, right across the agri-food sector, it kind of reminds us that it is a core leadership trait that we like to see everywhere and anywhere in society. So RJ, thanks for your generosity today, for your patience with my landlocked understanding of aquaculture, and for painting such a vivid picture of a part of our food system that I genuinely didn't know enough about. I'm grateful that you're doing the work you're doing, and I'm glad that Jen made that introduction and helped shape the conversation in the way that it did. Now, if you want to learn more about the Future Herd, about the conversations we're having about leadership in the agri-food sector, head over to our website, thefutureherd.ca, where you'll not only find information about the episodes, but knowledge that we generate after each one to really deepen the opportunity for literacy and appreciation of where this food or where our food comes from. And of course, if this episode gave you something to think about, share it with your friends. Give us a rating. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platforms or YouTube. And we'll see you again real soon.